I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as expected, today President Barack Obama signed an executive order ordering the closing of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center within a year. He also signed orders reviewing the military trials of terrorism suspects and banning the harshest interrogation techniques. And in doing this, one of his first acts, Obama may have created a high-wire act. Scott Silliman is executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University. And Scott, what's the thinking on the part of legal scholars as to how much of a high-wire act this is? Can Obama close Guantanamo within a year?
I think he can, Robin. What he's doing with the executive order is fulfilling a campaign promise. It will take the better part of a year. It's going to be very dependent upon diplomatic overtures to other countries to try to find a place to put these 245 folks that are currently at Guantanamo Bay.
Well, other countries have offered, as you've said, and that might be fine for, say, the Uyghurs from China that the U.S. says aren't a danger to the U.S., but can't be returned to China because they'd face torture there. So they might be happy to go to, say, Ireland. But what about high-value detainees like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who claims to be the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, and wants a trial, wants to be martyred? The U.S. certainly can't send him to another country that might let him go.
Two different issues, Robin. One is just detaining those at Guantanamo Bay who will never face a trial. The other is, where do you prosecute those 25 or 30 for which there is some evidence that they committed a crime? The issue of where do you prosecute is something that the Obama administration is dealing with, but the vast majority of those at Guantanamo Bay will never be prosecuted. That is the problem for Obama, is where do you put those people who will never face any kind of a criminal trial?
And yet you don't want to release them because you fear they're dangerous.
That's exactly correct. There are many down at Guantanamo Bay who will never face a trial, but whom have made statements indicating that they will continue to want to seek out and kill Americans and others who have supported us in this long war on terrorism. That is not necessarily a crime. Nonetheless, they should be considered dangerous. And so where do you put these people?
And we know the Obama administration is working the diplomatic ropes to try to get other countries to take some of these people, as you said. But let's be clear about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who claims to be the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. His trial was just suspended. Does he get tried?
Well, he may be. If they try to bring his trial into the criminal courts of the United States, the question immediately arises as far as any statements that he may have made that would normally be used against him in evidence were procured possibly by waterboarding. And that means that statement, through coercion of that level, could not be introduced in evidence. So there would have to be totally independent evidence against him. Now, that evidence may exist, but on the other hand, it may not be in the interests of justice to bring him into the United States for a trial in the federal courts. It may be better to use a military court-martial, not a military commission, a court-martial, the same system that we use for our own servicemen and servicewomen. You could conduct a court-martial anywhere in the world, and that system could be brought in to be used for folks like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib with a very minor word change by Congress.
And what's the minor word change?
It would just include unlawful enemy combatants as being subject to trial by court-martial, and that's something that Congress could very easily do. And a court-martial could be held anywhere in the world. I don't think it's probable that they will be brought into the United States. And remember, there are some down there for which there is no evidence of criminality. What do you do with them? That's what's going to take a year for the Obama administration to sort out.
Well, yesterday, reporter Gail Chaddock told us that the feeling is that these detainees, if they were to come here, would be treated like the nuclear waste that shuttles around on trains because no town wants it. No military brig, for instance, would want them in their town. But, you know, the High Wire Act seems to be that President Obama is offending people on both sides of the aisle. You have families of 9/11 survivors who are quoted as saying in The Washington Post, in his first official act as commander-in-chief, Mr. Obama has offered up the lives of 3,000 Americans killed in 9/11 on the ACLU's altar of political correctness in asking Guantanamo be closed. On the other hand, human rights groups aren't happy. Vincent Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York said it took only days to put these men in Guantanamo. It shouldn't take a year to get them out. So it seems like no one's happy.
I understand what the human rights groups are saying, but it is not something you can just open the door and let them walk out and go wherever they want to, because most of the world believes that folks like Ramzi bin al-Shib and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they are dangerous people, and you need to be concerned about where you put them.
Scott Silliman, Executive Director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University. Professor Silliman, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, President Obama is also expected, as soon as today, to overturn President Bush's prohibition on funding to international aid groups that perform abortions or that refer women to abortion clinics. It's a ban that's been off and on through several administrations and an issue that still draws passionate response. About 200,000 people joined the March for Life to the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. today to protest the 36th anniversary of the decision to legalize abortion. And on this anniversary of Roe v. Wade, we want to revisit a conversation we had with Dr. Susan Wicklund. She is an abortion doctor who opened her own clinic in Portland, Oregon, in Portland, Oregon, just 3 years after abortion was legalized. We spoke to her last year about her book, This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Doctor. It's now out in paperback. It reveals the struggles, dangers, and questions she had to ask herself as an abortion doctor. Take us to the very beginning in your own procedure. You don't paint a very pleasant picture.
It wasn't. And I want to just preface by saying that I'm not sorry I had the abortion. It was a good choice. I'm very grateful that it was legal at that point. Unfortunately, I was in a clinic that did not pay a lot of attention to providing patients with a lot of information or really attending to their emotional needs. When I was scared, instead of explaining what was going on, I was basically told to shut up and lie still and eventually held down. And then because I fought, being held down, was given an injection and basically knocked out. That is not the norm today. I think about that procedure and what happened to me and how I felt about it with every single patient that I see now.
You could have left that room and said, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to telling other young women not to do this because it was a bad experience. Instead, you went in the other direction. Why?
I hadn't expected to be doing primarily abortions. I started out going to medical school because I loved doing births because of my own abortion, and I felt like doctors should do it better than what I'd had it done. I sought out and learned how to do abortions myself while I was in my internship. And when I went into a small practice in my hometown, expected to do abortions for my own patients, which is, I believe, how it should be done, and was told by the hospital board that I absolutely could not.
Because?
Well, because, of course, nobody in that community ever had had unwanted pregnancies, you know. You know, it was just this big blinders that go up, this total denial. So I started inquiring at some of the clinics within a couple hundred mile radius that provided abortions for women if they needed help. And the response was incredible. It turned out there was a huge need for physicians who were trained in doing abortions and that were willing to come to the clinics and provide that service.
I'm thinking of a point in your medical career where you were considering other aspects of medicine, and then you came across a woman who desperately asked you for a procedure and you didn't perform it. What happened?
Yeah. I was, you know, at the bottom of the chain of all the, you know, med students, interns, and she asked if I could please help her. She couldn't continue the pregnancy. She said that her man would kill it, the violent situation at home. She didn't have any money. The state did not pay for it, and I couldn't find anyone that would provide the procedure for free or for a reduced rate for her. Social services wasn't willing to plan on taking the baby away from the home until they saw a reason to. Mm-hmm. And she asked me about it many times throughout her pregnancy. I was not able to help her. In hindsight, I would have done things differently.
Well, because 1 week your pager goes off, you're called to the emergency room, and you go there to see what?
She's holding a dead infant. She's given birth and gone home, and a short time later returns to the emergency room, and the baby is dead. And she said, basically said to me, this is your fault.
Now, you don't say that if the husband killed it, but that seems to be implied.
It's something I can't comment on.
Did you feel responsible for that?
I felt very responsible for not meeting the needs of a patient that asked me for help. I did come to realize that it wasn't my fault that child was dead. It was largely my fault that the child was born.
You were also influenced later by a beloved grandmother?
Flower Grandma.
Yeah.
Well, I'd been providing abortions for a couple of years by that point, actually almost 4 years, but I wasn't talking about it publicly. However, there'd been an incredible onslaught of protesters and violence directed towards myself and my family, both at the clinics and in our home. And there was going to be a special on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. My grandmother never missed 60 Minutes. So I went to tell my grandma about the 60 Minutes piece before she saw it, that I, you know, worked in women's reproductive health care. I was trying to approach it gently and see how where we were going to go with it. And she basically had me get up and come and sit down beside her by her rocking chair and proceeded to tell me the story of when she was a very young girl and her friend had gotten pregnant. My grandmother suspected it was incest but didn't know that for sure. The young woman knew that she couldn't continue the pregnancy. It was very taboo. And so Grandma and her sister were going to help the young woman end the pregnancy. She told me some details, but not a lot. Basically said they used something sharp and to start the bleeding, and they knew that would end the pregnancy. And the bottom line is that the young woman bled to death, that my grandma sat in the bed with this girl as she bled to death and was discovered by the father of the young girl, and they were, my grandma's sister and her were told they could never, ever speak of this to anyone. And Grandma sat and told me that story. She basically said to me she was glad that I was doing abortions safe so that women wouldn't die, so that women wouldn't be murdered by their best friends. And that's how she saw herself, as a murderer.
Well, you mentioned protesters. At this point, you say you're wearing a bulletproof vest, carrying a gun, commuting between clinics in different states, wearing disguises. Because abortion doctors had been killed, you were receiving death threats, you had a stalker. Describe what was happening.
In Montana, at our home, we woke up one morning to people shouting, "Susan kills babies." We're living at the end of a 3-mile dead-end road out in the woods. The house was surrounded by people we didn't know, obviously. There was a banner across the driveway that said, "Susan kills babies." There was a bassinet on the doorstep with a doll in it spattered with red paint and fake money. People basically blocking the driveway. My daughter ended up having to ride to school in a police car a number of times. They went to her school. They followed me to and from the airport, tell other passengers they shouldn't get on the plane because there was a baby killer on board.
Your stalker, Michael Ross, was writing unbelievable letters to you, telling you how he was going to kill you. In your own county, no one would do anything, but then you wrote to another county where he was active, and their response was, "You're kidding me."
It was just chilling. We talked to the local police, and everyone just said, "Well, until he does something, we can't do anything about it." And then a clinic in Missoula, Montana, had a fire. And the next day, I received a letter from Michael Ross saying, "Gosh, see what happened in Missoula. I wonder if you're going to be next." So we sent all the letters that we had at that point over to the fire marshal in Missoula, and they apparently sent those letters to the county attorney in Missoula, who called me and said, "My God, this is outrageous. This is a felony crime. It's called felony intimidation. We're going to have him arrested and charged immediately." And they did, and there was a subsequent jury trial, which I had to testify and read some of these letters. He was found guilty of felony intimidation and served quite a number of years in federal prison.
Well, I was going to ask, you said served. Is he out?
He's out.
Do you still fear for your life? And if so,
I do.
You know, then writing the book, doesn't that make it, you know, more dangerous?
It does, but in the bigger picture, this is what has to happen. I'm more afraid of abortion becoming illegal than I am of something happening to me as an individual.
Susan Wicklund, an abortion doctor. When we come back, why she believes so strongly in it despite a terrible mistake she once made, here and now. Welcome back. And today on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, we're revisiting our conversation with Dr. Susan Wicklund, who became an abortion doctor after having an abortion herself in the 1970s, right after it was legalized. Her book, This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Doctor, is now out in paperback. Before the break, we were hearing how Susan Wicklund was routinely in potential danger from abortion protesters and was also worried about the safety of her daughter. And I asked her why she continued in the face of that threat.
The biggest reason I was able to continue working is because I had an incredibly supportive husband and an incredibly supportive daughter. I never said to her then, although in hindsight, I know that she understood that she was the one person who could have gotten me to stop. And I think the protesters know that. They know that the weak link is often with the doctors' families, particularly their kids.
Well, let's talk about the procedure. You insisted on screening patients. You seemed very concerned about performing an abortion that you or the woman might regret. And you are brutally honest about the one you did, Mrs. P., who came into you.
Yeah.
You didn't know that she and her husband thought her pregnancy was the result of a rape. You performed the procedure and then found out what?
We found out that the embryo was not a result of the rape, and that was my fault. every woman, I ask every single one, are you absolutely sure this is what you want to do? Is this your decision, or is somebody pushing you or forcing you to have this abortion? And if anyone hesitates in the least on answering that question, we stop.
You even in some cases seem to say to women, you know, I'm not sure you're a candidate here.
Absolutely. Sometimes the body language is screaming no when their voice is saying yes. I listen to the body language. I would much rather have a patient be extremely angry with me or even to the extent of taking legal action against me for not doing an abortion than for doing one.
But Mrs. P seemed clear. Afterwards, what happened?
First of all, when we were ready to start and I asked her those questions and she said she was sure, she said to me, I can't continue this pregnancy. That should have been my clue. I should have asked, is there a medical reason? Is there something else? And I didn't ask that. And then when I was done, I always look at the tissue, the products of conception that comes out of the uterus, came into the room and asked how she was doing. And she said she was so relieved that she could never have continued this pregnancy because of the rape. And when she said that, my heart just sunk. My legs went weak, and I sat down, kind of crumbled down into a chair because I knew that she was 2 weeks different. She had conceived 2 weeks before the rape.
With her husband?
Yeah, she'd conceived with her husband, which was devastating for all of us. All of us ended up having to deal with it with counseling later on. They were very forgiving. They knew that this was not information I'd had ahead of time. I have not done a single abortion since then without an ultrasound first. I will not make that mistake again.
But some would say, even that one mistake, that might be enough for someone to say, oopsie, that's the reason why we can't have this procedure at all.
That's absolutely ridiculous to think that we should outlaw or not allow abortions for any woman because of single things that may happen to an individual woman. Absolutely not.
You also tell the stories of women who write you and come to you thanking you.
The letters and calls and squeeze of the hand that I get from women after I've seen them is extremely helpful. Pictures of kids when women come into the clinic and we see that, again, their body language or some part of them is saying no and we send them away. I hold them very precious and I'm very grateful.
What about laws? For instance, a law that would mandate that a woman take time to think about her pregnancy, like a 24-hour waiting period. You seem to almost be kind of advocating that in the interviews that you do with women and the counseling. But what if it were law?
Well, it is law in many states, and that's a real barrier. My goodness sakes, look at places where you've got women who have to travel a big distance. And if they have to come to the clinic and have information that's state mandated, then leave and come back to the clinic at a later date twice, find time off work, find child care.
How about whether girls under 18 should be allowed to get an abortion without a parent's consent?
That's really hard. I mean, when you say, well, you know, don't you want minors to tell their parents? Well, of course you do. The reality is the huge majority of minors do talk to their parents about it. But there are a handful of situations. There are some women who can't, whether it's because of potential violence in the family. She needs to have an alternative, a court system, to get permission from a judge. But, of course, that's another barrier.
Do you have sympathy with people who really just, they have an uneasy feeling about abortions? Do you have sympathy with that?
Oh, of course. I have a lot of sympathy for people, even if they're out in front of the clinics and are just there being available if somebody does want to talk to them. There are many people who I've talked to over the years.
What was fascinating is the number of times you had women who were actively anti-choice who ended up in your office.
Yeah.
How did they rationalize that?
I just didn't know. I didn't realize what it would be like to actually have an unintended pregnancy. Many times it was for the very reasons they were condemning other women, whether it was economic reasons or career reasons, because it's their life. They've got breast cancer or cervical cancer. If they don't end this pregnancy, they may die. And when I talk to them and say, do you feel that the woman who lives next door to you, are her reasons any less than yours? And they're willing to look at it in a different way.
Well, Susan, you paint an incredible picture. And yet I'm wondering, is this history? Are abortion providers still living in the way that you describe?
Well, I was told yesterday there was a clinic in Arizona that was burned to the ground in December. But you're right, it's off the radar.
In fact, you write of a physician with a clinic who was under assault and literally put an ad in the paper and said, where are you, all of you that we helped? Are you saying something to them as well? You know, maybe not to come out, but to what? To support the people who were there for them?
Absolutely. One of the things that's hurting us in our quest to keep reproductive rights available to all women is that we don't talk about it.
And it seems that being able to talk about it will allow that woman who may have some emotional pain, even though she had a procedure that she very much felt, you know, she needed, she has no place to put that pain.
That's right. I think you put it very well. And I'm so hoping that this book will open the dialogue and make people understand that it isn't just politics, it isn't theory, it isn't just law, it's individual lives. Nothing is black and white. We make decisions at any given time in our lives based on the information we have at that moment. And that's what we have to remember.
Our conversation from last year with Dr. Susan Wicklund, her book, This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Doctor, is now out in paperback. Okay, still ahead today. The British film Slumdog Millionaire just got a nomination for Best Picture Oscar, but it's going to open tomorrow in India. How will it be received there? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Barack Obama has been busy moving some of the legislative furniture in Washington, overturning Bush policies, as we've just heard, mandating that none of his staff can become future lobbyists in his White House, which is also getting an overhaul. Michelle Obama announced that California-based interior designer Michael Smith would be her pick to lead a restoration of the White House. And she says she's looking forward to adding her own touch to the East Wing and creating a living space where her family feels comfortable. So, where to start? Well, Deborah Needleman, editor-in-chief of Domino Magazine, essentially wrote an op-ed this week that the Obamas should ask, what would Jackie do? Jackie, of course, being Jacqueline Kennedy. Deborah, are you also encouraging the Obamas to, well, you know, obfuscate? Because as you write, Jackie Kennedy had an interesting legacy.
Jackie Kennedy sort of left the Obamas and left America a sort of double-edged legacy. She was basically the first one to understand that the White House is a living museum. And she walked into a White House that was rather shabby because prior to her, the residents of the White House could throw away, toss, auction off anything that was in the White House. So she arrived into a White House with very little of historic value into it.
Well, I would think so, because no matter how good a person is, you might want to take a little of that, you know, maybe the lampshade when you leave the White House. But Jacqueline Kennedy got Congress to pass legislation designating the White House a museum. She set up a fine arts committee
and a painting committee, but she also masterfully played politics to get exactly what she wanted. She wanted to bring authentic period furniture into the White House, but to balance the fact that it's a living house. It's the only museum that people actually live in, and that she was very concerned with making the house be a beautiful backdrop for the presidency. She put at the helm of her committee Henry Francis DuPont, who was the founder of Winterthur and the sort of premier authority on American antiques, so that it would look good.
But behind the scenes, we understand from your writing that the redesign was actually the work of a French decorator.
Which, of course, she wanted to hide from the American public because it wouldn't have seemed patriotic.
Well, in fact, on that network television special, The Tour of the White House,
yes,
Jacqueline Kennedy was asked, you know, are you the one who's going to decide what it's going to look like? And here was her answer.
Well, no, I have a committee which has museum experts and government people and private citizens on it. And then everything we do is subject to approval by the Fine Arts Committee.
But Deborah Needleman, as you write,
she wasn't being completely truthful there.
Yeah.
She did, you know, she did listen to their advice, but often ignored it. At one point, she had picked out the fabric that she wanted to use for the green room, but she had the White House usher send three samples over to DuPont to examine and to choose, but with a note to the usher that says, and won't he get a big surprise if he doesn't pick the third and realizes that I've already chosen it.
Well, and another time she smuggled the fabric she wanted from France through a diplomatic pouch.
Well, there was no company in America that could make the fabric exactly the way she wanted it, so she had to have it fabricated in France. She wasn't completely forthcoming, but what she in fact did was fantastic.
In fact, we also have her giving her opinion of the house. She was asked, do you have an agenda?
Well, I really don't have one, because I think this house will always grow and should. It just seemed to me such a shame when we came here to find hardly anything of the past in the house, hardly anything before 1902. I know when we went to Columbia, the presidential palace there has all the history of that country in it, where Simon Bolivar was, every piece of furniture in it has some link with the past. I thought the White House should be like that.
Jacqueline Kennedy talking about the White House. But Deborah Needleman, let's talk about the current White House. Your magazine has a room-by-room tour, and our listeners should go to our website, here-now.org, to see it. But tell us, what are the Obamas walking into?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Jackie Kennedy really did give the House a historical foundation that it needed. And they did bring in hundreds of pieces of authentic 18th and 19th century furniture, some of it which had belonged to past presidents. But it has not gone any further than where she took it. In fact, it's sort of devolved into very sort of strict period rooms, really as just these sort of collections of furniture in period rooms, almost in the way of like a colonial Williamsburg.
So what do you think, I mean, from the tea leaves, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, people were speculating in the office, will we see IKEA in the White House? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's interesting. I think the Obamas, I mean, at this point, the Obamas have hired their decorator, Michael Smith, just to do the private quarters. So it's unclear whether he will redo the staterooms. But I think what, in much the same way that Mrs. Obama has been dressing with American designers, but, you know, not Donna Karan and Ralph Lauren, but Maria Cornejo and Isabel Toledo and these smaller independent American designers, I think that there's probably going to be a sense of that brought into the interiors as well. And I feel that they'll probably be looking at underappreciated artists, furniture designers, artisans, to bring the house up to date and make it relevant again.
I'm wondering, too, if unappreciated colors. We've already seen the palette that Michelle Obama and the children wear. And will it move from being a, well, pretty much we've all seen the pictures, red, white, blue, and brown wood White House to something else?
I would hope so. I feel all the colors, I mean, personally, I feel all the colors have become very unsubtle. The red is very red, and the green is screaming green, and this was not always the case. So it would be quite nice for the colors to be actually a bit more historical and a bit subtle. Clearly, the family does seem to, in the way they dress, appreciate color and pattern. And at least in the private quarters, that's also something that Michael Smith is really adept at, layering patterns and colors. And he is also a decorator who, while taking a lot of influence from the sort of grand old houses of Europe and using very fine antiques, his work is very much filtered through his own kind of very American, Californian in particular, laid-back, comfortable, cozy, modern sensibility, which does feel sort of appropriate for the Obamas.
Well, there's arguments from Dominique Browning to have a more green White House, but others are arguing that it's time to give up the European-centered look of the White House and go for a more multicultural American look. Can you picture what that might be, what an item might be?
Well, I think there's amazing ways in which you know, they've got all of the National Gallery and the Smithsonian at their disposal and could really hang some art shows that show the sort of diversity of the American experience, even if these were temporary shows in some of the larger staterooms that the American public visits. And I think it's up to Mrs. Obama and her committee to really interpret the museum character of the house and what they want to do.
Deborah Needleman, editor-in-chief of Domino Magazine. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have the story of Oxford, Iowa in Pictures, a photographer who lives in town, took almost all the residents' pictures 20 years ago and then again today, and every American will probably find someone in town to identify with. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. 7-year-old Sasha and 10-year-old Malia Obama practically stole the show on Inauguration Day. Oh, that thumbs up from Sasha to her dad. But while the girls are in the limelight right now, most children of presidents end up becoming not much more than historical footnotes, and most are relieved at that. But Noah McCullough wants to change that. Noah is just 13 years old himself, but he's published a book called First Kids, The True Stories of All the President's Children. Noah, welcome.
Thank you.
And by the way, people may know of you because you may be 13, but you've appeared, on the Tonight Show, and you're something of a political savant, right? You love this stuff.
Yeah, I'm really into politics and history and everything that kind of makes our nation run.
Well, first of all, start with the Obama girls. Having looked at all the different kids through the years, what would you tell the Obama girls?
Well, I think I have some advice for President Obama and Michelle Obama, because a lot of it is not as much on the kids as it is on the parents and the responsibility of figuring out where their kids are, because some people that have been first kids have different attitudes towards it. Others see it as a stepping stone for a future career or a future job or something like that, while others look at it as a big burden that they have to bear, and that it's something where they try to live up to their father and mother's expectations, and it just bogs them down the rest of their life.
Can you name some that you think illustrate some of those points?
For instance, George Washington Adams, the son of John Adams. He was a very smart kid. I mean, all-A student, going to a good college. His future looked bright, but then when his dad was elected president, a lot of the burdens came down on him, and because of that, he started going into drinking and other forms to get rid of the stress. And it eventually got to a point where he dropped out of college, wasn't able to do much, and on a ship going home to his father for like a weekly or biweekly checkup report or something like that, he jumped off the ship and drowned.
Whew. Well, there's a lot of tragedy and sadness in the White House. I'm thinking of Lincoln's son, Willie, who was quite a cut-up, but he died at 11 in the White House of typhoid fever.
Yeah, he did die at 11 with typhoid fever, and the Lincoln family was never really the same. Willie was the one who kind of brightened up everybody in the home, and he was Tad's playmate and companion. And after Willie was gone, Mary Todd Lincoln got into a huge depression, and Tad was never the same either.
Yeah. Well, but there was also great joy and fun in the White House. Of all the hundreds of children who've been through the White House, which was the one that stood out most for you?
I think the most outstanding group like that would be the Roosevelt kids, because, man, they had a lot of fun in the White House. What they would do is they had this whole attack plan on these foreign dignitaries, like foreign presidents and prime ministers and kings and stuff like that. Whenever they were coming in for like a meeting or a dinner or something like that, the Roosevelt guys would stay on top of the White House. It was like the front porch, and they would drop water balloons on these foreign dignitaries. Then the Roosevelt girls would bring out some of their animals, including Alice Roosevelt's pet snake, Emily Spinach, to release into the dining room.
So these are Teddy Roosevelt's kids. And,
yes.
And Alice Roosevelt would have to be one of the most colorful of all the president's children. As you said, brought her pet snakes. But also, she was a teenager in the White House. And then, you know, as she grew, she smoked, she drank, she had quite a big life.
Oh, yeah. She definitely enjoyed her life.
Well, through your book, we learn that George W. Bush is the only president to be the dad of twins. Give us some other little tidbits that you came across.
Well, let's see. The presidential ticket that had the most kids was William Henry Harrison. He had 10, and then John Tyler had 15, so they had 25 combined, which is why they were called the fertility ticket. I've also done some research on my own of the Obama children. I know that Malia's name means queen in Swahili and princess in Hawaiian. Sasha's real name is Natasha Obama.
You have, I understand, a very specific plan for yourself for the White House.
Definitely. I want to run for president of the United States in 2032.
Okay. Why should we consider you? Even you're 13, but, you know, we might as well start early. Why should we consider you?
I think that going up the ladder to try to get to the presidency and possibly the presidency itself, my whole goal won't be for personal success, but it'll be for success of the entire country and myself doing whatever I need to do in order to make America a better place.
Noah McCullough, ladies and gentlemen. He's author of First Kids, The True Stories of All the President's Children. It's really a fun read. He also is a candidate for president in around 2032. Noah, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay. Coming up, Slumdog Millionaire gets a Best Picture Oscar nomination, but how will it be seen in India? It opens there tomorrow. We'll hear in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. The Academy Awards were announced this morning in Los Angeles, and drumroll please, the sleeper hit Slumdog Millionaire came up big. 10 nominations, including the coveted Best Picture, and also one for English-Irish director Danny Boyle as Best Director, and several music nods, one for the song that ends the film, Jai Ho. If you haven't seen the movie yet, you've probably heard that sound or the ads touting it as the feel-good movie of the year. The story of the young man from the slums of India who wins the Indian version of the TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and in so doing also wins the love of his life.
In Alexander Dumas' book, The Three Musketeers, two of the musketeers are called Athos and Porthos. What was the name of the third musketeer?
But Slumdog Millionaire is more than a game show. It opens tomorrow in Mumbai, and there is huge excitement. But an Indian living in America says her fellow countrymen may be in for a surprise.
I actually walked out of the movie.
You walked out of Slumdog Millionaire, one of the most highly touted films. You're of Indian origin. I mean,
yeah, I know. It was a joint decision with my friend who's an American, so it was both of us who decided to walk out. But I think I just couldn't take it anymore. I was actually sitting there with my eyes closed. So.
Well, that's no way to go to a movie with your eyes closed.
No, it is not.
That's Maya Chahardi. She was born and raised in India and now lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And she's not alone. Today, about 24 slum dwellers in Mumbai protested outside the home of one of the film's stars. Because while Slumdog Millionaire follows that young man's progress on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, it also weaves in flashbacks to his life in the slums. As Maya, who happens to be a neighbor, explained to me, each question on the show is somehow attached to an experience he's had and one that resonated for her. And this warning, some of the scenes that so disturbed Maya may be disturbing for you as well.
Well, I went to see that with a friend because it came very highly recommended by the critics. And I think pretty soon into the movie, I found myself getting more and more anxious.
Why? What was it about the film that so agitated you?
I think some of the stories that were told, I could anticipate what it would be. And I'll give you an example. I think there was a question related to a very famous poet who's blind. And so when they have this flashback and they show them in sitting in this mound of dirt and they're taken in by two men who they think are their, you know, well-wishers. And the moment I saw that the men took them to this house where there are children who are beggars, I knew what was going to happen. I knew that this was, you know, part of the begging industry where children are disabled to gather more sympathy on the street. You know, sometimes their hands are cut off, sometimes their legs are cut off so that they become objects of sympathy on the street. In this case, since the question related to a famous blind singer, I knew that one of them would be turned blind, actually. And so for me, it was almost 8 minutes of anticipation, knowing that this is going to happen. And when they were actually doing that, I thought it was done in a very in-your-face manner. You have this little boy lying on a bench with his eyes blindfolded, and they show another person, you know, heating up rods. And
Heating up rods to burn his eye out.
Yeah, I mean, like I was, you know, half looking because it was just making me so anxious.
This is interesting because I knew something was going on, but maybe I didn't have the anxiety leading up to that moment that you as an Indian did.
Yes, and I told my friend actually as well that they're going to make him blind. And he said, what? And I said, yes, they're going to make one of these guys blind. I thought, okay, I don't really need to see this. I know what the issues in India are. This is just not, it's hitting. It just didn't make me feel good about being there.
How much is your reaction to the film also that for many Americans, this may be the first time they see a film about India and this is what they're seeing?
Yes, I think partly the question did arise in my mind. Is this the kind of image that, you know, a lot of people who would see an Indian film for the first time would have about India? So that also bothers me a little bit. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't show India as it is. But if this is the first impression people have, that's a very strong impression to give. Having said that, I also think that if this movie is trying to expose some of the issues that exist in India, from public hygiene to other issues like the begging industry, etc., I think that's a good thing. But if this creates the image about India and the rest of the world, that's probably not so good to me as an Indian, because there's a lot more to India than, you know, the picture has depicted.
We're getting a sense that there's a lot of pride and excitement on the part of Indians that there's a movie out, sort of the feel-good movie of the year. Are you worried that suddenly they may see that's really not what it's about?
Yeah, I mean, if you see, I think Bollywood makes more than 800 movies a year. I would say almost 700 of them are feel good. So if you want to see feel good, there are many feel good movies where you have people who come from very poor backgrounds, they become very rich. I mean, Bollywood is all about that kind of stuff. So this is not special from that perspective that a guy from the slums has made it big. But I think the Indian audience might be a bit concerned about some of the scenes that they see. I suppose the question would be, what kind of action comes out from this? You know, does it stir some action in the right way? But there could be a risk that it is, you know, it's exploited or romanticized or trivialized a little bit. And, you know, maybe there is a thing that, well, it's okay if you're in the slum, you can break away from it as well.
Yes, it's always good to have a hopeful message, but it might be a false message that you too can go on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and get out of the slum life.
That is true. But I think one should definitely not underestimate hope. And I think if you really watch it and see it fully, I would imagine that you probably don't come out the same person from the movie hall. And so from that perspective, I think it can change you because you do really see how millions of people live. And if you can't turn yourself blind to that, at some point it has to affect you.
Maya Chaudhary from India, but living in America and reacting to Slumdog Millionaire. Well, as we said, Indians in India are reacting as well ahead of tomorrow's opening. Bollywood superstar Amitabh Bachchan excoriated the film on his blog. Keshni Kashyap is a U.S.-based filmmaker, but she's currently in Mumbai writing about Indian culture for the blog site The Daily Beast. Keshni, many people we know there are very excited about the film. But do they understand that it's more than Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? It's very grim.
Many people I've overheard actually saying, who've actually seen it, either they've seen it on DVDs or they've seen it in the U.S. or they've seen it on illegal copies, have loved it. Indians have loved it. Indians, you know, they're sophisticated film goers here, and they also know that it's one perspective. It's Danny Boyle's take. Danny Boyle made Trainspotting. Trainspotting showed the underbelly of Glasgow, you know, or Edinburgh, actually. To kind of make extrapolations about this is somehow going to ruin the good name of Indians for the rest of the world, I think is a somewhat myopic view.
Well, we understand Danny Boyle and the cast were very defensive at a press conference yesterday with the Indian press. They felt the need to defend the movie. What do you think the reaction is going to be in the press?
It's varied. There's somebody like Amitabh Bachchan who wrote on his blog that he didn't like the way that Mumbai was portrayed. But then there was a piece in the Times of India yesterday written by Shobha Day that was like a love letter to Danny Boyle, thanking him for actually bringing light on to this sort of an issue. And I think the movie, as grim as it was, it really wasn't cynical. And I think that a lot of Indians are going to appreciate that. I mean, it is a kind of joyful movie that's about hope, and it's very from the heart.
Keshni Kashyap, a U.S.-based filmmaker, currently in the Indian film capital Mumbai, writing on Indian culture for the blog site The Daily Beast, ahead of tomorrow's opening of Slumdog Millionaire in Mumbai. Keshni, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Oh, so I'm